Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories, where we play tales to take you away from today. And do we take you away this time?
Oh, really?
Really. Gary Rowan, author of the sci-fi short story collection Journey, is here to talk about his book and Slotsky Bear.
Okay.
We have Santa Facts from Jim, Strange Christmas Traditions from Betty, and Tom Tells It Like It Is in Southern dialect.
What did you say?
I said, let's listen to this week's 5-Minute Mystery.
Another 5-Minute Mystery.
This 5-Minute Mystery is being brought to you by expensive shows. This past week, I went to see how much it would cost to see a Fleetwood Mac concert. Even the cheap seats were out of my wheelhouse. Oh well, on with the show.
That was a grand show, Pete.
At $5.50 a seat, it had to be.
There you go about money again.
And why not? If I had it, we'd be married by now.
We can't wait for my uncle to die, to inherit his estate.
I'm sorry, Margaret. No bank account, no marriage.
Pete, if I get some money, will you do as I ask?
Maybe. But how are you going to get your hands on any?
Never mind how. I'll get it.
Hey there, Miss Talbot. You sound grim. What are you going to do?
Get a dowry for my marriage?
Hello, this is Graham.
Mr. Graham, this is Inspector Todd, police.
Police? What's the matter?
I'll have to ask you to come down to my office at headquarters. Your fiancé's uncle has been killed in an automobile wreck.
Good heavens, of course, I'll be right down.
Pete. Oh, Pete, it's horrible. Uncle Mike.
I know. Now, please, Margaret, stop crying.
I'm Inspector Todd, Mr. Graham. Do you have a chair, please?
Oh, thank you.
Now, about the wreck. I've already told you about the car going off a cliff.
I knew something would happen to him with that new English car of his. He was just learning how to drive it.
We have evidence that points to murder, Miss Talbot, not an accident.
Murder?
Yes. Our investigation proves that the steering wheel of the car was tampered with. The wheel broke on a treacherous stretch of road about a mile from your house, Miss Talbot. It was a clever scheme.
A completely fiendish one.
I agree. Miss Talbot, I'd like very much to question Mr. Graham alone. Would you wait outside for a moment, please?
Of course.
I'll put my cards on the table, Mr. Graham. I believe that your fiancé killed her uncle by fixing that wheel.
But she couldn't have done it. She's innocent, I tell you.
Well, why are you so certain?
Because I loosened the wheel.
You?
Yes. I decided to do it last night. We were sitting in the car in the garage, and we were talking about the future. Pretty soon, I had my arm around Margaret, and I thought how swell it would be if we could get her uncle's money and marry.
Which arm did you put around her?
Well, the right one, of course. What else when I'm sitting at the wheel? After I took her to the house, I came back and did it. Now, please, let Margaret go home.
I'm afraid I can't do that. Your imaginary confession, despite its nobility, completely absolves you from the crime. Your fiancé tampered with that wheel, not you. And I'm holding her for murder.
What slip did Pete Graham make in his confession to Inspector Todd? In just a moment, we'll know.
How in the heck do they expect us to know what's going on? Did they give us enough information to solve it? And can you believe that they paid $5.50 for a show? That's totally outrageous. No wonder they can't get married. Do you want a hint for this one? Okay, think New English car.
And now, back to our story.
Your confession fell apart completely, Mr. Graham, when you told me that you had placed your right arm around her while you were at the wheel. Since the uncle's car was of an English make, as Miss Talbot pointed out, the steering wheel is at the right of the car, making the arm position you described impossible. No, Mr. Graham, your motive does you credit, much more so than your storytelling. I wanted you to convince me of a few details. Your confession proved your innocence and her guilt.
Okay, in truth, I can't really see how the detective's explanation proved anything. Just because the steering wheel is on the right side does not mean he couldn't put his arm around her. What if she was sitting in the driver's seat? Huh? Oh, these five-minute mysteries. Sometimes they're so silly, and this one was brought to you by Expensive Shows. Blog last week, I did a true and false with Santa thing. In response to that, my very own brother sent in a few facts he had. Jim from the Land of Enchantment writes, "Hi Ron, I heard you do Santa facts last week. My biggest selling book, soon to return to print, is The St. Nicholas Solution. I was in the hospital in 2002, not doing well, so my wife gave me something better to do. She gathered original documents about St. Nick from Europe, and I put together the book. It included Santoids, factoids about the real Nick. Here are two based on original documents as presented in my book. Santoid number one. Where is St. Nicholas laid to rest today? His first burial place was in Myra, Turkey. But then, as Islam swept through the regions, sailors from Italy stole his remains and brought them to Bari in Sicily for safekeeping. A great church was built there to the honor of the saint. But that was not to be his final resting place. In the late 19th century, the relics of the saint were transferred to the main chapel of St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church in Flushing, New York, a suburb of Queens. Today, if you want to visit the burial place of Nicholas, you need only fight the traffic to the corner of 196th Street and Northern Boulevard. It seems somehow appropriate that the place where the image of Santa was so decisively shaped by men like Clement Moore, Thomas Nast, and the advertisers of Madison Avenue should also host the final resting place of the saint whom all the legends rest. Santoid number two. The basilica built in Bari, Italy to house the remains of St. Nicholas is one of the greatest churches in Christendom. Completed in 1108 CE, the actual construction was carried out by Muslim building crews brought in because of their mathematical and material skills. These Muslim workers managed to play a bit of a trick on their Christian overseers. Using Arabic script, they carved out a special message above the door where worshippers would enter the basilica each Sunday. As these devout Christians walked into their church, they walked under a stone that bore, in a script they could not read, the message, "There is no God, but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet." Jim from Albuquerque, New Mexico. That is good stuff. My thanks to my brother Jim Thompson for sharing those. You can find his book, The St. Nicholas Solution, on Amazon. He has also just released a new updated edition of his book, Kali, a novel, which you can read for free on Kindle Unlimited. This book follows the brutal murder of a Los Alamos physicist. It provides the setting for an intellectual adventure exploring the realms as varied as quantum physics, occult symbolism, radical theology, and secret technologies. Thank you, Jim. And now, these are your stories.
These are your stories, sent by you, for you.
The This story comes from Betty Duncan, who is a resident of the great state of Washington, my home state. Betty works as a school teacher, is a published author, and is a mother of three kids. Betty has sent us this strange Christmas story. I love the paranormal, and I love collecting stories. I know this must sound strange, but every Christmas Eve, my family gets together to play games and share ghost stories. The rule is that every family member that comes to the celebration must tell a story. It can be real or made up. One year, my sister hosted the celebration at her brand new home. She and her husband had just bought the place from auction. It was run down, a fixer-upper opportunity, and over 100 years old. They had made enough progress in their restoration to want to show off the place. Over the past few months, I received a number of calls from my sister about strange things happening in the home. So it came as no surprise when she opted to go first to tell her ghost story. Here is the story that she told, and by the way, my sister's name is Mary. Mary was working on the house one Saturday afternoon. She was sanding the banister in the entrance hall, getting it ready to be repainted. As she was working, she was humming her favorite working song, Kemptown Races. Why is that her favorite? I have no idea, but she has done that since she was a little girl. As she was singing, she felt like someone was singing with her. However, each time she stopped, the voice would stop. She assumed it was some sort of echo and continued working on the banister. After a while, she began singing again. The echo returned, but this time it was an octave lower and definitely sounded like a man's voice. She stopped again and said, "Hello?" From the staircase above came a man's voice, which clearly said, "Hello, Mary." Immediately, Mary ran upstairs to see what was going on and found that she was alone in the house. She offered no explanation and ended the tale. We all looked at her in disbelief. She smiled, saying that every time she's working in the house and begins to sing Kemptown Races, she can hear that echo. We laughed again, but she was insistent. We went on with our Christmas tradition, and in turn, each of us told a scary story. Another Christmas Eve tradition is that we would end the night singing Christmas carols. My sister would play the piano, and we would gather around. Another rule of the evening is that each person would have to pick their favorite carol and solo the first chorus. We call this tradition Christmas karaoke. This time, my sister did not go first, and we all took our turn. We sang Silent Night, O Christmas Tree, Hark the Herald Angels Sing, and many others until only my sister remained. She looked around, smiled, and began to play. Kemptown ladies, sing dis song, doo-da, doo-da. De Kemptown racetrack, 5 miles long, oh, the doo-da day. We all joined in, and by all that is holy, I swear there was a voice added to the group. A low bass voice echoed from the upstairs balcony. All of us heard it, and I will swear in a court of law, it's true. My sister has finished the restoration of her house. It is now a beautiful home that we gather at each Christmas Eve. However, we now have a new tradition, and that is to end the evening with the singing of Kemptown Races. Betty Duncan, Everett, Washington. Man, I got chills again. Thank you, Betty, for your story, and be sure to thank Mary, too. I can honestly say I've never heard a Christmas story quite like this one. Amazing. I love it when we have authors on the show. When I originally started the podcast in 2011, it was my idea to have a different author every week. In fact, I may start a new podcast one day and do that very thing. Today, we have such an author who has created what I think is a triumph of science fiction short stories. It is called Journey and was written by Gary S. Rowan. Gary is an agent, author, syndicated book reviewer, and has been doing it for 30 years. His reviews have appeared in hundreds of daily and weekly newspapers. He has been a talk show host, and he was co-host on Desperate and Dateless. Gary has also authored two books of poetry, Look at Me World and Made by Man. It is my pleasure to welcome Gary Rowan to the show. Welcome to the podcast, Gary.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with just tell us a little bit about you. How did you end up being a critic and author, both? That's kind of rare.
Started in 1973 when my parents and I formed a publishing company. It was Chateau Publishing because we had a particular publisher that looked at my dad's true crime book, Murder of a Little Girl. It was a case that happened here in 1969. It was a vicious case. And my dad wrote the story. And we had a publisher, but something happened, and so he distributed the book. But we formed our own publishing company, and I became the salesperson that also, when we branched out and did other authors, I became a press person, a press liaison to get authors onto different shows, get them interviewed by newspapers, and I learned the craft of that. Then I had a friend in 1978 or 79 that suggested that we do a talk show on one of our colleges here in Orlando, Rollins College. So we did the show, and then we hooked up with newspapers around the country and then book companies around the country, and we reviewed. And at that time, they would send us anything under the sun, but we were concentrating on science fiction. I had always been a writer. I was on the newspaper staff. I took writing courses. Then when I went to UCF, I was on the writing staff of the newspaper. And later, I returned to UCF, University of Central Florida. And as far as I'm concerned, they're number one in the country right now because they're 25-0, 2 years. And I have not gotten quite the recognition, but I recognize. And so I'm very pleased to acknowledge that I learned my craft to be better because, as you point out, in my collection Journey, Blank is a story I wrote a long time ago in tribute to Isaac Asimov.
Yeah, we had that on, we had Blank on last week's show. Very good story. Loved it.
So I had the writing background of a father who was part of the writing field, but was also writing for magazines, which I do. And then I just learned my craft so much better at UCF from two professors, Susan Hubbard, who publishes books with Simon & Schuster, and Pat Rushen, who taught me the mechanics of things that I wasn't doing and said, try this, very helpful. And they're both amazing published authors. And I have such a debt of gratitude to those two. I worked in different professions, different things, but always was doing the reviewing, which led to me being an agent because I had the connections with the publishers. But I always wanted to continue to do my own stuff.
When I first got your email to me, the thing that caught me was something that a reviewer said of your book. It was all about a teddy bear named Slotsky Bear. And I was intrigued. And so that made me want to go find out who this Slotsky Bear was and come to find out that has quite the story. Well, first tell us about Journey and then why Slotsky Bear?
Well, Journey came about recently in the last 2 years because setting up with all these publishers, I had connections with many different publishers around the country. And we have one very fine publisher, Legacy Book Publishing here in Orlando. They've done not books that are bestsellers on the New York Times bestseller list, but bestsellers for the authors. And they do very well where the authors take them and what they do with them. So my take was, I know Gabriel Vaughn, the publisher of Legacy. I asked him to consider my short stories. He was familiar with them because over the years of 25, 27 years, we'd go to lunch and we'd talk books and he would hand me things to review. So I said, well, what do you think of you doing my collection? And by this time, I had the Slotsky Bear stories ready to publish. Now, how that came about was when I worked in market research. I worked in one of our malls. I worked in most of the malls in the Central Florida area, going up to Jacksonville, going down to Sarasota and Tampa. And I've worked across the state in market research. And that's a fun thing where you engage people at, say, Taco Bell, and you get them to do a survey and you pay them to do something, or in the mall. So one day I was trying to bring people in to do surveys, and I saw this ear in a trash can. And I think that's why I put him on a trash can. I saw this ear of something, and I thought it was a real animal. I didn't know what it was. And finally, I got the courage to go pull it out, and it was a teddy bear. And what I describe in the story, as I described in the prologue introducing Slotsky to the world, was a fierce-looking teddy bear that could sit in a chair and be enough that it would be like a person, because you know how teddy bears are, cute and cuddly and small, and we love them. But there was nothing redeeming about this one, except I came up with the idea that there's something that lives in the bear that when you have a problem, and the first one was, there was a guy that was trying to break in. He broke in to a husband and wife's home, and the husband brought the bear home. Then he decided he was going to name him Slotsky Bear. I just toyed with different names, and that's how I came up with Slotsky, because I liked the implication it might be Slotsky's Deli, but it wasn't. And I just played with it and came up with the name Slotsky. So he takes the bear home, and by the end of the story, the perpetrator is dead. But there's no explanation for how he died. And so I just have it that they look at the bear and think, nah, it couldn't have been. And so story after story gives you a little hint more of what he is. But in the first collection, Journey, I don't explain really what he is. I've always had in mind what he is. And he relates to a story in Journey called Ryan's Passing, where it's a story about a man dying, and he confronts someone after he's dead. And I just left it in the Twilight Zone type of fashion. But it was also a story I wrote at UCF. So I took that whole premise, and in another collection, I explained kind of what Slotsky is and where he came from. The fun of it, the joy is, I come up with things each time and just say, how can I put something in? Hey, where can I put this in? What can I do? And I am very open to seeing things and aware. I'm like a television camera, because I learned from Robert Newton Peck that an author has to be like a television camera and take everything in and just store it. And then I take notepads because I don't know when I'm going to use it. The bear came from what I said of the market research. Did not intend to write him, but that night I went to dinner at Hooters, and I was sitting there, and all of a sudden the intro for Slotsky Bear started happening, and I wrote it down on, of all things, a takeout menu of Hooters. And the girls all said, what's going on? I said, I got to go home. Let me pay for my meal. I got to go. And I wrote Slotsky Bear.
You wrote a prologue to kind of introduce the character a little bit. And I'm going to ask you, would you be willing to read that prologue for us right now?
Oh, definitely. I would love to.
All right, well, take it away.
On top of a trash pile sat Slotsky Bear, too big for the garbage can that was next to the mound. He thought about the world he lived in. Hope someone comes along soon to take me away from this neighborhood. I need a Calgon moment to just get away from it all. In the last few minutes, people had gone past and commented on his appearance as they walked their dogs or jogged by. Some said, "Look at that evil-looking, gross teddy bear with fangs and large, scary claws. He's just not what I want my kids to have around the house. He's just too frightening." Slotsky heard their comments but chose to ignore them, wrapped up in his own thoughts. A gray, well-fed rat with a long tail scurried along in front of Slotsky, teeth ready to get a morsel of the bear, even though it would only be cotton stuffing it might taste.
"I wouldn't do that if I was you."
The parasite stopped in his tracks, mouth closed for a second or two, his whiskers and snout twittering as he thought, "Who said that?" He looked at the bear in front of him. "No, it can't be you, because you're just a stuffed animal on his way to the dump, and I'm going to have a taste of you before you're carted off and enjoy myself."
"I think again, pal. I'm not quite what I seem, and I warn you again. I wouldn't do what you're thinking of doing."
The good-for-nothing creature pondered his next move as he heard again,
"This is your last warning, or else I'll have to take action. And you'll not like the end result of that, I'm certain."
At that, the varmint chose to ignore the warning given and proceeded to take a chomp of what he thought would be a very tasty meal. Suddenly, he was launched into the air, then thrown into the dirty metal garbage can with a loud crash that echoed for a second before he landed on the ground in a daze.
"Want some more? Try it again, and you'll get a second helping. Worse than the first."
Instead, he pulled himself together and began to move slowly into the street in front of him, unaware of the black Toyota Camry that moved along at a fast rate of speed. The car had its windows open as the sound of loud music shattered the quiet of the neighborhood. A moment or two later, the two met each other as there was the noisy squishing sound as the vehicle continued on its way, the driver oblivious to the fact he had hit something.
"Oh well, that's one less rat in the world. Life goes on, or so they say, and mine is never dull."
That was fantastic. What caused you to write the prologue?
The prologue was the idea of my publisher for Journey, of Gabriel Vaughn. We sat at dinner one night and he said, "I think you need a prologue to introduce the character that you've written." So we hashed out what it could be. And the next morning I sat with an author. I was going to have lunch with an author before she showed up. I sat and came up with it on notepads, came home from my meeting with that author and put it in the computer, arranged it, set it up, and changed it and tweaked it, sent it on to my publisher, Gabriel Vaughn of Legacy, and he said, "Yeah, now it works." And so that's how the prologue came into being.
So how many Slotsky stories are there?
Good question. I think there's 25 or... Yeah, there's about 25 Slotsky stories. Second edition or second book, Slotsky's World. I'm looking for a publisher for it. I've already written one or two more for a third collection. And so in Journey, there are 8 stories that have him somehow in the stories, either as a cameo, where I wanted to put him in somehow, but did not want him being the focus, or 7 stories where he is involved in the whole process of the story. The rest of my stories are Twilight Zone type stories because I grew up watching the Twilight Zone and being influenced by it. So it's a whole collection of different science fiction stories I've written over the years.
One of the things I really liked about your book was that after each story, you tell where the story came from and why you wrote it. And, you know, I have seen people do that before, but never successfully like you did. I think that was great.
I wanted to do that simply because at science fiction conventions that we have in the area here, like Oasis or, you know, some of the others, when I'm on panel discussions and I've talked about my short stories, a lot of times people say, where's it come from? What was the influence? Now, the worst question that a person can get who's a writer is, where'd you get the idea?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, let me explain a little bit of it, of where the process came from, so that people get an idea that it's an ongoing thing. As I stated, that you know, I'm the typewriter that I'm always looking, I'm always finding something that strikes my fancy. And that's how The Bear came into being, and that's how most of my stories happen, simply because I hear something and I just jot it down on a notepad and
turn it into a story.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, that's incredible. Yeah. You know, something else that I noticed, mm-hmm. and I don't know if you knew this, but I don't know if I'm telling you this for the first time, but I edit books for a living. That's what I do. And one of the toughest things in the world to do is to write a good short story. There are some stories in your book that are, what, 66 words long. How do you do that?
That came with the story in the book, Identity Theft. I was at MegaCon, the comic book convention that's grown and grown and grown here in Orlando. And I'm sitting next to a woman that is an author, and I value my friendship with her. And I talked to her briefly, and I said, hey, I heard that somebody's going around editing a collection that's going to be something like, what, 66 words? She looked at me beaming and said, I am the editor. I said, oh, my God. So I had my notepad. I said, here, what do you think of this? And she said, get it into 66 words, but I love it. And it was called Identity Theft, and it was 66 words. Now, I'd always seen other collections from Dahl of 99 words of the major science fiction writers, and it was a test of their abilities to tell a full story in 99 words. So this was an even bigger test of a writer's ability. But because I write the poetry the way I do, it's a different form. It's free form. It's been compared to E.E. Cummings, but you have to be, with that type of poetry, very precise, very ongoing, and say what you mean and get in and get out. And so 66 words was not really a problem for me to do. And so I wrote three that are in the collection Journey. And then I continue to write other ones just to see if I can do 66 words. I've even written one that's in another collection and 32 words.
Wow.
And still, you know, it's tough. But you have to really just pace yourself and think. Now, as you heard with what I read of the prologue, I'm very careful about the words I use. Now, I'm also a book critic, and the thing that just really, you know, just gets me is an author like Daniel Steele, who uses "and" button suddenly 20, 30 times a page.
Oh, I hate that. Absolutely hate that.
Now, I have a writing exercise that I give to writers because I'm also an agent. I'm also, you know, out there as a consultant. So this is one that I give to writers to try to do. That is, read Daniel Steele, get a pen, cross out every time there's "and" button suddenly. See if you can put another word that might do it. I don't believe in starting a sentence with "and." I don't believe... No. Reading a sentence with "but" or "suddenly." Mm-mm. And she does it too much.
Well, "suddenly" is okay if it's used just once or twice, but
once or twice. Yeah, exactly. Not 36 times a page. Now,
you know what bugs me?
What's that?
Oh, I hate it's a very good, or I hate the word "very" at all.
Oh, I do too. The other thing that I noticed is the reason I came up with the exercise is not to get people to not use and button suddenly. It's to train the writer to look at their writing and say, hey, I'm using the house, the word house, too many times. When I get up, here's an example. The character is in a car. And a writer writes car, 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 car. So I say, Jake got into his Mustang, Ford Mustang 1969 convertible, or Jake got into his green Ford Mustang 1969 convertible to give you that he's in a car. He's getting in his car. Mm-hmm. He drove his automobile down the road. He put his foot to the pedal. Okay. He didn't accelerate the car, You see what I'm doing?
Yeah, of course. I agree with you 100%. Word usage is very, very, very important. See now what I just did there? Very, very, very. It's just stupid. It's stupid when the word is just.
People have a thesaurus. They can use it, but they don't choose to. They're lazy. And I use it all the time. Especially when I think, hey, I've used that word too many times. What's another word I can use? Hey, what can I do here? What can I do here?
Exactly. I agree with you. I tell people to always stop and read aloud what they've written. Because if you do that and hear yourself repeating the same word over and over again, you're going to realize how bad that really sounds.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's my training as a book critic or a reviewer that has spawned me to see this. And it was just, I just became aware of it with Danielle Steele because I used to read her. Her stories are okay. They're not great, but they're well told, except for the writing that she does, which is so I have reviewed her for years and said that. So she cut down, but 18 times on 3 pages is still too many times.
Oh, I agree.
3 pages.
I have another question for you, and this is kind of maybe me just being intuitive or just guessing probably. But one of the things that I looked at when I was looking at your book, now I haven't read all the stories, I'll be honest, but I've read a good number of them. But the name Journey struck me as more of a personal title than an actual title for this book. Am I right about that? Is that it's your journey of collecting these stories?
Kind of. It started as the actual title started as a writer's journey. What I wanted to do is take readers through the progression of me as a writer, beginning with the short stories I wrote a long time ago so that they could see the difference after I went to UCF and was trained by Susan Hubbard and Pat Rushen. My publisher, Gabriel, said, no, let's start with the Snotsky stories and let's introduce him. And then we came up with the prologue. And I was like, yeah, I like that. And then he said, let's call it Journey. Because then it gives the suggestion, yeah, it's me. But it also, if you look at science fiction, Journey is a totally appropriate title, especially with the cover of the book, with the bear on the moon, and you got a trash dump next to him, the Earth in the distance, and a spaceship. So suggest that it's a science fiction collection. And that was the brilliant cover design of Gabriel Vaughn. He is a master at what he does. So we combined our talents and came up with Journey, and I'm quite pleased with it. I'm having so much fun with it, and readers are telling me they enjoy the stories very much.
Oh, they're well written. Let me tell you, Gary, right here and now, is that you do have a talent for presenting a story. And you know what I like is not when just one style. A lot of authors, they say, oh, this is my style. This is how I write. You take Isaac Asimov. You could always tell when Isaac wrote something because it sounded like Isaac. But you have the ability to use several different styles. And I bet that has a lot to do with your background and having read so many different things.
I think you're right because I study. I'm not even aware that a lot of times that I'm doing it, but I study and being the critic, I'm aware of different things, but my criteria, Jack Williamson, I met at Chi-Con back in 1991 in Chicago. It was the Worldcon convention. And Jack said to me, and the funny thing is, Playboy had a party for the convention because Playboy had many of the authors that were there in the magazine throughout the years. And we're talking to Arthur Clarke, we're talking to Joe Williamson, we're talking to all these authors. So Jack Williamson asked me, he had an entourage of people around him. He said, "You're a critic." I said, "Yeah." He said, "I've always wanted to ask a critic, what do you look for when you are critiquing or you're reviewing?" I said, "I can't speak for others, but what I look for is the author has to do three things. Tell me a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end." And that has always been my criteria for the stories I write. I want you to come in, read what I've written, take you through, and have you enjoy it all the way, but have it lead up to the ending that I provide. The funny thing was, the entourage of people around Jack said, you know, they thought it was hilarious. He paused. He looked at me. He looked at them. He says, "That's what I've been trying to teach my writing classes for years." I feel good company then. Very good company.
Oh, my, yes. So how can people find you, your work, and or hire you, your services as an agent? How do people do that?
They can go to my Facebook page. They can go to my LinkedIn page. I think I said it right, LinkedIn or whatever. They can contact me through Twitter. They can also, you can provide my email addresses. We have two. AOL sometimes works, but I would recommend the Yahoo account. Just let me know. The other way is they can purchase books through Amazon and any bookstore. They can go and request them. I have another book that I'm promoting too, The Forgotten Father. It's Taylor and Seal Publications, and it's up there as an ebook. Journey is an ebook, and I suggest to people whatever way you want to read my book, but Amazon has them. Any bookstore, you can order them. And I spell my name R-O-E-N so that you get the right spelling, because God knows what happens when you put it in the computer.
Well, I'll make sure that I have all those in the show notes and make sure that people are able to find you. And I do want to thank you, Gary, for being with us today. It has been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And thank you for reading your beginning of Shotsky the Bear. What a great concept. You know, I've read a couple of those stories now, and pure entertainment is what they are. Thank you for being on the show with us today. Thank you for all that you've done. And thank you for a masterful book called Journey.
Oh, thank you. Can we quote you on that?
You certainly can. You know what? I will even leave you a review on Amazon.
Okay.
Once I finish it, though, I got to finish it.
Yeah, okay. It helps. That helps.
Thank you, Gary.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was a whole lot of fun, and I want to thank Gary Rowan for being with us today. His book, Journey, is available on Amazon, and if you missed any of the links that Gary spoke of, I will have them in the show notes. And now, this.
As read by Amazing Stories, read by Amazing People.
This time on As Read By, we continue growing up with Tom Williams. Tom lives in Berlin, Germany, was raised in Alabama, and has sent in these tales from his youth. This time, Tom takes a trip back in time to talk about the Southern dialect in a tale he calls
Growing Up, Pronunciation, and Humor. In my last story, you noticed that I gave you the correct Southern pronunciation. I, by no means, was making fun of my Southern folk. None whatsoever. I hold deep fondness for my Southern past, with certain exceptions. These exceptions would only put a cloud over what should be pleasant memories. So with your permission, I'll still leave those exceptions out. All over the world, there are many dialects and accents. Once in southern Germany, a farmer was trying to have a heated discussion with my company commander. Frustrated, I was called over to translate it by the commander because the farmer didn't speak a word of English and the officer didn't speak one word of German. Listening to the rantings of the farmer for several minutes, the officer finally held up his hand in disgust and said, "What is this man saying?" I had to explain that I too didn't understand a word either. "What? Why not?" "Well, yes," I said. "I didn't understand because he has a thick southern Bavarian accent, and I learned German in Berlin." The officer thought that a language is a language. In the South, for example, ice cream was pronounced by my cousin as ice cream. A car was a car, and barefoot is barfoot. After living up north for decades, my return home for a family visit was a trial and error for the first few days. Mom, I would notice, was reading my lips until I slipped back into an accent she felt comfortable with. Everyone still notices my slight accent nowadays, as I'm sure you do. To place a little humor on myself, too, I always thought that a car had a dry shaft and not a drive shaft. I hope you can certainly hear the difference. My army buddies never let me live that one down for a long time. Another example is the word lard, the type of cooking ingredients. It was used heavily in the South in our biscuits and fried chicken and stuff like that. Most meals had some form of lard in it. Now, not to be sacrilegious, and I hope you don't accept it that way, it's just a bit of humor, but imagine a 5-year-old child, me namely, not knowing why they recited the "Lord is my shepherd" verse. It was embarrassing until I finally caught on. Humor was, besides hard work, the only way to get through hard times. That and a swig of cheap wine, moonshine, or whiskey when they could afford it. My dad had a good sense of humor, though. He reminded us that he was so poor that when the Depression hit the South, it actually improved his standard of living. Sometimes his humor backfired, though. I always wanted a bicycle of my own, and I knew it would almost be impossible. But one day, after getting home from school, Mom said that Dad was on his way home from work and that he was bringing a bicycle home for me. I have never been so excited in my life. I couldn't wait for him to walk in the door. Where would I put it? Where would I ride to the first day? I'd figure that one out later. As he entered the door, I was looking around and behind him. He reached in his pocket and brought out a, above all, red and yellow plastic bicycle the size of his thumb. "I got it for you, but it shrank as I was bringing it home in the rain, Tommy." I was devastated, and my world fell apart as a 6-year-old child. He honestly didn't mean to be mean. He only thought it was a good joke. He only wanted to be funny. No one ever rushed in the South. Even their speaking was in a slower manner compared to today's kids. Today they speak so fast, I don't know if they even stop to draw a breath. For example, Dad's speech was like the way he felt about punctuality. "I'll be there when I get there" was one of his favorite sentences. And if you remind him that he's late, he'd reply, "For what?" If you ask him if he would come over at 5, he would also use the term, "I'll be there around 5 o'clock. So you'd better plan for 6 if you're lucky. Why, those 5 o'clock flowers that I mentioned before in my grandmother's yard that closed up at night at 5 o'clock were more punctual than my dad. But anyways, here's to those double scoops of ice cream on hot sunny days. Sincerely, Tom.
Thank you, Tom. And again, you remind me of my past. I spent 17 years working as an engineer for a major chip manufacturer here in the United States. One of my many jobs I was tasked with was to work with contractors hired to install high-tech equipment. I remember one job where I worked with a contingent from Japan. These guys were great fun, and every morning I would meet with them to discuss what they would need for the day. I always had a translator to help me, but one day he was sick and it was just us. I thought I could get along okay because the guys spoke a little English and I had learned a little Japanese. We talked for some time and I thought we had a pretty good handle on things, and I was even proud of myself. That is, until I got a call from security. It appears I gave one of the guys permission to bring his wife and kids in to the plant for a visit. Not something I was even authorized to do. In the end, I made it good by signing in his family as personal friends of mine and taking them on a personal tour. So it turned out okay. Thank you, Tom, for your stories. I can't wait to hear what you have for us next time. That's all I got. I want to thank Gary Rowan for joining us today on the podcast. I also want to thank Jim Thompson, my brother, Betty Duncan, and our own Tom Williams for your contributions. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to ronsamazingstories.com. There, you'll find everything you need. And please do leave reviews and feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.
All of the vintage audio used in the podcast is believed to be in the public domain. Ron's Amazing Stories does not own the rights to any of the old-time radio used here. If you hold the rights to any of the shows played, please contact us immediately at ronsamazingstories.com.